You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. No one compliments you when their paycheck's correct. But make one mistake and you risk alienating your entire workforce. Kronos makes sure your payroll is done right the first time, from punch to paycheck. With embedded checklists and simplified workflows, Kronos is your single source of truth. With Kronos, you get HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping in one unified system, all with a proven implementation approach and simplified, transparent pricing. Learn more at kronos.com/payroll. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. When Valerie Jarrett interviewed a promising young lawyer named Michelle Robinson in July 1991 for a job in Chicago city government, neither knew it was the first step on a path that would end in the White House. Jarrett soon became Michelle and Barack Obama's trusted personal advisor and family confidant. In the White House, she was known as the one who got President Obama and helped him engage in public life. Jarrett joined the White House team in January 20, 2009, and departed with the first family on January 20, 2017. And she was in the room, in the Oval Office, on Air Force One, and everywhere else when it all happened. No one has as intimate a view of the Obama years, nor one that reaches back as many decades as Valerie Jarrett. Now she shares those memories in a new book titled Finding My Voice, My Journey to the West Wing and the Path Forward. And on today's podcast, Valerie Jarrett recalls what she calls a magical childhood, spending the first 5 years of her life in Iran, the difficult transition for her when her family moved back to Chicago, and how her own experience a few years later as a single working mom influenced her to advocate for women and families in the White House. She remembers her first impressions of Michelle and Barack Obama, shares her unique perspective on their marriage, and tells the story of the time Michelle Obama recruited her to help convince a young Barack Obama to give up politics and get a real job. Of course, we know how that went. She talks about being the one who kept President Obama connected to the world outside of Washington as Director of Public Engagement and Intergovernmental Affairs. She describes the surreal and heartbreaking experience of watching the 2016 election returns with the Obamas in the White House residence and reveals what's been the hardest blow to take from the Trump administration. Plus, she shares a few of what she calls her pinch-me moments from her 8 years in the White House. Coming up with Valerie Jarrett in just a moment. Valerie Jarrett was the longest-serving senior advisor to President Barack Obama. She oversaw the offices of public engagement and intergovernmental affairs and chaired the White House Council on Women and Girls. Jarrett has received numerous awards and honorary degrees, including Time's 100 Most Influential People. Before joining the White House, she served as the executive officer of the Habitat Company in Chicago, chairman of the Chicago Transit Board, commissioner of planning and development, and deputy chief of staff to Chicago Mayor Richard M. Daley. She's currently a senior advisor to the Obama Foundation and a senior distinguished fellow at the University of Chicago Law School. Now she's written about her remarkable life, from her childhood in Iran to the Chicago mayor's office and all the way to the Obama White House, in a new book titled Finding My Voice, My Journey to the West Wing and the Path Forward. Valerie Jarrett, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm just delighted to be here with you today.
Well, as I mentioned in the intro, you spent the first 5 years of your life in Iran, which you describe as a magical childhood. Now, this was back during the days of the Shah, before the Iranian Revolution. And, you know, Americans today, we don't usually use the word Iran and magical in the same sentence.
Yes, regretfully so. Things have certainly broken down. But back then, the United States had a great relationship with the government of Iran. And in fact, the government was interested in recruiting physicians from all over the world to help start new hospitals throughout the country. And my father, in the mid-50s, was unable to find a job at a teaching hospital to do his academic research with a salary equivalent to his white counterparts. And so he traveled halfway across the world to be not perceived of as just a black doctor, but an American doctor who was respected based on the merit. And he worked really closely with physicians from everywhere. And I grew up in a hospital compound playing with children who spoke multiple languages. And it was a very enriching, happy childhood for the 5 years we were there.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that back then, at least in that sense, Iran was more progressive than the United States.
That's the point I'm trying to make in the book. He went a long way to be to find the job that was going to be the most rewarding to him.
And when you moved back to Chicago, was that a hard transition for you?
Yes, it was. So from Shiraz, we moved first to London, where my father received a fellowship at the Galton Labs at University College of London. And from there, a year later, he was recruited to the University of Chicago Medical Center. So the irony is he had to go halfway around the world to find a job right back in my mother's hometown that he wanted in the first place. But he said that's like the adventure of life is sometimes the shortest distance to where you want to go is the longest way around. And for them, they were returning back to my mom's hometown, to the place where my father had done his residency and was very familiar to them. And it felt like a foreign country to me. I had developed a British accent after spending a year in Great Britain, and they placed me 2 years ahead of myself in school and a public school in our neighborhood, and I used to get beat up after school all the time for being different.
In both senses, you say that not only did you feel like an outsider among white people, but the black students at your school
thought you were too light-skinned. Exactly. Nobody thought I fit in, and I felt like my parents are so happy, and this is also familiar to them. Why does it feel so foreign to me? But I learned an important lesson, which is that I was resilient, and I dropped the British accent, and I stopped speaking Farsi, and that I regret. I regret that I wasn't comfortable being who I was. I just wanted to be like everybody else. But that's, I think, how kids are.
But I think it must have helped that your family, especially having your grandmother around, who definitely seemed to be firmly rooted in their heritage and their identity.
Yes, very much so. My grandmother Puddin, we called her, or Dorothy LaVon Taylor, was the matriarch of our family, and the walls of her apartment and my mother's sister, who lived in the same building with her, were just full of photographs of our ancestors. And I used to, while we were playing, I would just stop and stare at those photographs and try to imagine what life was like for them. And there's an enormous amount of pride in our family, I think, for the fact that so long ago, we were a family of achievers who believed in education. In fact, my great-grandfather, Robert Robinson Taylor, was the son of a slave from Wilmington, North Carolina. And his father, once he was freed after the Civil War, saved enough money to send my great-grandfather to MIT. And that kind of made me feel like things may seem impossible until they're inevitable, and that you can overcome unfamiliar challenges. And I think that helped me accommodate myself to being in Chicago as well.
Yeah, and your parents were both big proponents of education in your family, and you eventually went to Stanford and then to law school at the University of Michigan. After that, you got married and you had a career at a prestigious Chicago law firm, and then later in the mayor's office. You were essentially, during that time, a single working mom because your husband at the time, you describe him as being sort of aloof, and he was off doing his residency in Michigan while you raised and supported your daughter. How did that experience influence your later efforts to advance policies like the Equal Pay for Women and the Healthy Families Act?
That's such a good question. I remember being, you know, this young, single, working mom. Never in my wildest dreams did I think my marriage would fall apart, but it certainly did. And I was just feeling like I was hanging on by my fingertips. And I was a lawyer, so I had the ability to afford the best childcare. My parents lived in the same neighborhood with me, and my dad took my daughter to work every single to school every single day on his way to work and brought her home. I had everything going for me, and I still felt like I was hanging on by my fingertips. And so back in those early days, I used to think, well, my goodness, if it's so hard for me, what must it be like to that single mom who's working two shifts in a factory and doesn't have flexibility and doesn't have a support network and leaves her child through no fault of her own in circumstances where she doesn't know if they're safe. And it motivated me to say, what can I do to make it easier on working families? One of my responsibilities in the White House was chairing the White House Council on Women and Girls. It was the first time ever that a president had created a council that had representatives from every agency in the federal government, and we were all supposed to look at our missions through a gender lens, and are we doing right by women and girls? And of particular interest to me, in addition to women's preventive health care, was the basket of issues I call working family issues. And I kind of lived them, and so I thought, well, what would have been helpful to me when I was a young single working mom? Well, workplace flexibility. If I didn't show up to take Laura to a doctor's appointment or a Halloween parade, nobody showed up. So I needed the flexibility to do that. I needed to know that I was getting paid the same amount as my male counterparts because I was the sole breadwinner in our family. That's important to working families. Having paid leave. We are the only developed country in the world. Only one that doesn't have a national paid leave policy.
Is that true? Wow.
That's what I said when I first heard it. Yes, it is true. And so you have to say, how are we going to be globally competitive for talent when you could go to Sweden and get a year off for paid leave? And here in the United States, there's no guarantee. Sick days, it's something like, the last time I looked at this number, and it was like 43 million Americans don't have a single paid sick day. Well, everybody gets sick. And frankly, when you're sick, I don't want you coming to work with me, right? I want you to stay home and get well, or if you have a sick parent or a sick child.
Same here.
And so that's important. Affordable child care is important. And the other thing that I think is certainly topical now, and I'm so heartened by the leaders of the Me Too movement and Time's Up, but you need to have an environment where you can work free from sexual harassment or sexual violence. And That's what we need for working families to thrive. And so being an advocate for them, I come at it from the position, not just is it good for the working family, certainly it is, it's good for business. In fact, it's a business imperative because we're all trying to not just attract but retain the most talented people. And if you can't fulfill your responsibilities outside of work, how are you possibly going to thrive in work?
And you came into public service in an interesting time in Chicago under the first black mayor, Harold Washington. And then when Mayor Washington died, he was succeeded 2 years later by Richard M. Daley. You decided to stick around, even though his family, of course, had the reputation for the old school Chicago machine politics. Were you skeptical? And why did you decide to stay around and give him a chance?
I loved my job.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, I had had a job where I was miserable, so I knew the difference between being happy and being miserable. And I had a very good friend, John Rogers, who knew Mayor Daley well, and he said, I want you to give him a chance. And in fact, a few years earlier, he had seated me next to then State's Attorney Daley at my friend's wedding. And I was like, why are you sitting with him? Why aren't you sitting with my friends and family? He said, Valerie, he's going to be mayor of Chicago one day. You'll be thanking me for this. And he said, why wouldn't you just stay and try? You can always leave. And I'm glad I stayed because it turned out Mayor Daley did try to continue Mayor Washington's progressive agenda and expanded upon what I think Mayor Washington didn't have a chance to do because he died so early. And it was the best thing that could have happened to me. It's where I was able to run my own department. It's where I think I found my voice and really became not just an advocate for the people who didn't have representation in the city of Chicago, but also I became an advocate for myself. And it's where I met Michelle Robinson, who turned out to marry this guy named Barack Obama.
Yeah, you actually ended up becoming an early mentor to the Obamas as well as a close friend. What were your first impressions of Michelle and Barack Obama back then?
Well, I remember when I first met Michelle Robinson, she came in for an interview. I had heard about her, and I, the description was brilliant young lawyer who doesn't want to be at a big firm, is interested in service. And I thought, oh, that's that woman after my own
like
heart,
you.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about the brilliant part, but certainly committed to service and not interested in a big firm. And she walked in my office, and she saw her resume on my desk, and she never said, you know, nothing about Princeton and Harvard and all. She figured I could read. She told me her story, and it's this quintessential American story that we all now know so well about growing up on the south side of Chicago, working class family, parents who hadn't finished college and yet had instilled in both she and her brother Craig the sense of a value of education and a responsibility to give back. And she just blew me away. I offered her a job on the spot. I didn't have any authority to offer her a job, but I thought, who could turn this wonderful woman down? She wisely demurred, and a couple days later, we were talking, and I said, well? And she said, well, I talked it over with my fiancé, and he doesn't think it's such a good idea. And I said, well, who's your fiancé, and why do we care what he thinks if you want the job? And she said, well, his name is Barack Obama, and he started his career as a community organizer, and he's concerned about me going from a law firm right into the fire. You at least went to the frying pan practicing law for a few years. Would you have dinner with us to talk it through? Because we make all big life decisions together. And I said, yes, and I'm very glad I did. And I was just so struck when I saw the two of them together, not just that they were, you know, obviously crazy about one another, but there was a respect for one another. They listened to each other. He asked me questions about Iran in a way that I had never really been asked before.
Really?
And, well, because usually people say, well, so where are you from? And he said it, and I said, Chicago. And he says, well, did you grow up here? Yes. Were you born here? And I went, no, I was born in Iran. And usually I prepare myself for all kinds of reactions as you get to that. And instead, he said, well, that's interesting. I spent time in my childhood in Indonesia. And we started comparing what we had learned from these experiences outside of the United States. And at the end of the dinner, I thought to myself, well, this is the first person I really met who got me and who understood what it was like to see the United States from the vantage point that we shared. And to have kind of culture shock coming back to this country, but yet appreciating this country in ways that people who've not lived outside the United States sometimes take for granted, like our civil liberties or even clean water and food. And my mom, you know, boiled and peeled everything I ate and drank and worried about diseases that could have been devastating. And then we also said to each other that, you know, the United States is the greatest country on earth. It's not the only country on earth, and we can learn a great deal outside of our shores. And I think that informed our view about really both foreign and domestic policy, those early years.
Yeah, a lot of that sounds very much like the things that were coming out of Barack Obama's mouth just a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
It sounds like there wasn't a huge change between the young Barack Obama and the Barack Obama became president.
Well, as his wife said quite famously, being president didn't change who he is. It simply revealed who he was.
Yeah.
And I think that's very true.
And in one of the lighter moments in the book, Barack Obama had lost his bid for Congress and was considering a run for Senate. And there's this great moment where Michelle wanted him to kind of give up on this pipe dream of politics and get, quote unquote, a real job. So she asked you to host this brunch with some friends to talk him out of it.
It didn't go well at all. But what I remember most vividly about the breakfast, other than at the end of it, he asked me to chair his finance committee, which I wasn't expecting to do, but that I told him I was afraid for him. I was afraid that after having been having lost to his race against Bobby Rush for Congress, to so soon run for a statewide office when he couldn't even win his district, his congressional district, I was afraid that his political career would be over if he lost. And I remember him saying to me, Valerie, if I'm not afraid, why are you? And what's the worst thing that'll happen is that I lose again and I can always get a job. It's not a matter of that. And I think the timing is right. And when you think the timing is right, you got to go for it and be prepared to take, you know, whatever comes your way and work really, really hard and see what happens. And it, as it turns out, my advice was not so good and he was right.
We're going to take a quick break and then I'll be back with more with Valerie Jarrett when we come back in just a moment. Hulu's newest original series, Rami, premieres April 19th, only on Hulu. Based on the real-life experiences of comedian Rami Youssef, this groundbreaking comedy series takes viewers into the world of a first-generation American Muslim on a spiritual journey in his politically divided New Jersey neighborhood. Rami brings a fresh new perspective to the screen as the series explores the challenges of what it's like to be caught between an Egyptian community that considers life a moral test and a millennial generation that thinks life has little to no consequences. The series features postmodern meditations on love, work, and identity through the eyes of a modern-day Muslim-American millennial and his family, and explores how challenging it can be to find deeper meaning in today's hyper-connected world. Don't miss the premiere of Hulu's newest original comedy series, Rami. All episodes streaming April 19th, only on Hulu. And now, back to the podcast. Now, when did you know that Barack Obama was going to run for president? Did you have a feeling?
I think, when I first met him, of course, I said he'll be president one day. Now, I thought? I think I mentioned it in the book. I thought, maybe one day he could be mayor of Chicago. Wouldn't that be incredible? Because that was what I viewed as a ceiling, having known Harold Washington had been mayor. So I couldn't have envisioned this. But I will say, when I heard him speak at the Democratic Convention in 2004, I remember sitting in the convention center and thinking his message is one that I think will resonate around our country, red states, blue states alike, because it's a message of inclusion and hope and bringing out the best in us and seeing what we have in common as opposed to our differences. So I thought one day he could be. And then after he wrote Audacity of Hope, and I saw the kind of reaction he was getting from his colleagues in the Senate to come and do fundraising for them, and he was really the senator most in demand, I thought he might move this schedule up sooner than I thought. And he called me over the holidays at the end of 2006, beginning of 2007. And I remember I was with a friend and a cousin and sitting, getting ready for dinner. And he called, and I stepped outside to take the call. And he said, I think I'm going to do it. And I knew what it was. And I said, great. I'm not going to make the mistake I made when I told you not to run for the Senate. And soon thereafter, he started having serious conversations. And just as Michelle had included him in the conversation about her job, she was at the meetings talking about whether or not he should run for president.
Really?
And he knew he couldn't do it without her full support. Yeah. And fortunately for her and for the country, she said yes.
And you've been around to see them at their best, and at times probably when their marriage was perhaps under more strain than a normal marriage, both very strong personalities, and at times you describe this sort of recurring tension between Barack Obama as the big starry-eyed dreamer who's always looking toward the next step, and Michelle, who is more pragmatic, the one who wants to maybe take a breath and approach things more cautiously, think about the impact on the family. How do they make that partnership work?
They talk and really communicate with each other. I've never seen them hold back with one another.
Really?
And I think there is a confidence and security that comes with marriages where you can be open, but that doesn't mean it doesn't cause tension. Michelle Obama in her book, Becoming, speaks very openly about seeking counseling. And I think as all working families can relate, it is hard to raise children and have two working parents with demanding jobs. And for his, you know, there were several weeks out of the year where he was down in Springfield. And even when he wasn't in Springfield, he was in high demand. And she, by all, you know, everyone would concede, most importantly, that she bore the brunt of the responsibility for raising their children. And she's a terrific mom, but it's hard. And I thought it was so good that she was willing to speak openly about that in her book, not just to her friends, because I think sometimes we moms try to make it look easy or pretend that it's easy, even try to pretend to ourselves, oh, we've got this and we're superhuman and it's no problem. And I think we're doing ourselves a disservice. We're doing our friends a disservice because our friends go, well, she thinks it's easy. Why is it so hard for me? And to open up and say, look, raising children under the best of circumstances is hard. But it's not always hard. They grow up and then you move on to another chapter. And so part of what I try to say with some humor in the book is that you've got to breathe and you've got to enjoy the fact that you're doing the best you can and you're not superhuman and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And I did not need to be up at 2 a.m. making baby food from scratch. That just wasn't necessary. She would have been fine without it. And so some of that we put on ourselves, and some of it is societal, and it's what employers put on us. And that's the piece where when I was in the White House, I tried to address.
And initially you said you didn't want to go to D.C. You wanted to stay in Chicago, but you did eventually come to the White House with the Obamas. You were someone who was very close with them. You were invited to the dinners in the residence. You describe, you know, unwinding over cocktails on the Truman balcony many afternoons.
Aside from evenings, not so much in the afternoon.
After a job well done.
Yes, thank you.
aside from the skills that you brought to the Obama White House, do you think that your presence there as an old friend from the Chicago days who had a relationship with both of the Obamas, do you think that perhaps your presence there helped to anchor them and give them maybe a little sense of normalcy within this whole fishbowl for 8 years?
Well, I surely hope so. That was my intent. And just as I had friends who moved to Washington and did that for me, who joined the administration or even just moved to work in a different office from their job so that they could be close to us, those people in my life were really important. They grounded me. Mm-hmm. They joked with me. They weren't impressed with the fact that I was a senior advisor. They could still see me as like Lally, which was my nickname when I was a kid. And I think we all need that. And so I certainly tried to be that for the Obamas. And I think I became a better friend because I knew what he was going through in the course of the day. And I also think I was a better advisor because I knew his values and what he stood for and what he was fighting for and how important it was for him to be a whole and present dad. And I tell a story in the book about if I was ever in the Oval Office after 6 o'clock in the evening, I would just stare at the clock because I knew by 6:28 he needed to be heading back upstairs for dinner. Because keep in mind, his dad abandoned him when he was young, and he modeled fatherhood after Michelle's father, who was very present and engaged, notwithstanding a very painful disability that he had. And after 2 years on the campaign trail, he really wanted to be present. And I think her view was, you need a break. Even if you go back to work right after dinner, which he did every single night, he still worked for hours every evening. She thought it was important that the family was together and that they not sit around the dining room table waiting for him. Mm-hmm. That sent a bad message to their daughters and to him. Mm-hmm. And so as a friend, I knew, well, as an advisor, I knew we needed him and we needed to resolve the issues at hand. But as a friend, I know you got to get out of here by 6:28. And I start to wrap it up, speed up the conversation and try to get him out on time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure that that consistency also helps, you know, try to keep some sense of normalcy and routine.
Even for the president of the United States, it's important that when you come upstairs and you sit down with your family, they're not in the least bit interested in what happened in the Situation Room, and you can't talk about it.
Yeah.
They do want to tell you about their day at school.
Yeah.
And I think that provides some relief and some balance and a sense of grounding and perspective.
Now, you oversaw the Office of Public Engagement and Intergovernmental Affairs, which kind of puts you in a unique position to reach out to different constituencies and discuss policy proposals with the people who are probably most likely to be affected by them. In that role, did you feel that you were kind of the president's connection to the real world and those ordinary people, his barometer on the world outside of the White House?
Outside of the White House and outside of Washington, because in intergovernmental affairs, those were all the elected officials around the country, other than members of Congress. And because of my experience working in local and regional government, I had an appreciation for how important those perspectives are. And President Obama shared that perspective. Before he was elected, he spoke to the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And I could look around the room and just see that they were thinking, oh, you get it. We are the economic engine. And therefore, our perspective should be valued. And then the Office of Public Engagement was, as you said, the gateway for real people, a whole range of constituencies who cared mightily about engaging with their White House and their federal government. And he was so hungry to hear from them. And you said, we call them real people. And so the stories of real people came to him through my offices. They also came to him through 10 letters that our correspondence department sent up to him every night.
Right.
And he would come to work many a day carrying a letter and distribute it to the senior staff and say, this is who we're fighting for. Remind yourself why we're here. This is about service. It's about making tough decisions that might not be popular in the short term, but over the long haul will be good for people and for our country. And he wanted to make those decisions informed by the people who elected him and even those who didn't. And I think the difference between campaigning and governing is that you campaign and you try to enlarge in your constituency and your base. When you're president for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so it was important to him that we not just listen to those with whom we agreed, but also listen most closely with those with whom we disagreed to make sure that our decisions were truly informed.
The title of the book is Finding My Voice, and you actually led the effort to elevate women's voices within the Obama White House. What were the challenges that you and other female senior staff were running into early on?
Well, keep in mind, let's go back to when President Obama took office. We were in the middle of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression.
Right.
Millions of people were losing their homes. Millions of people were losing their jobs. We were trying to take steps to stave that and reverse that trend, not just keep it from continuing to decline, but to turn that, as we like to call it sometimes, that battleship around and in the end, you know, cut the unemployment rate in half. But in the process of doing that, there was a lot of tension. And when you first start in a new position like that, I mean, what's unique about the White House is you start with zero people. It's like a startup business, and you go from zero
right.
to
yeah.
thousands of people,
slate.
Like, you just in a matter of months. And I was one of the co-chairs of his transition committee, and I know how hard we worked to try to get the absolute best people we could. But initially, you're not a team. We were all connected and drawn to him, but we didn't really know each other that well. And I think that's the case in every business or a place of employment, frankly. And so, and when you start a new job, you bring with you the baggage from your last experience. And I think the most of the women in that senior group, well, they didn't know him the way I knew him.
Right.
And so they were tentative, and meetings without him would be loud and boisterous, and people would be yelling, and
yeah,
just
and
the
you
natural
particularly
tension.
Describe Rahm Emanuel as being
he was a pretty good
little,
yeller.
Little
he liked to yeah, he liked
to,
and he just says
yeah.
how he let off steam. But I think what I noticed is that the women, several of them, their voices were beginning to shrink, and so I mentioned it to President Obama, and he goes, "Well, that's not acceptable. That's not the culture I want to build here. I'm going to invite everybody over for dinner and we're going to talk about it." And that was one of his strengths, is that he didn't shy away from confronting a challenge because he knew it just, you can't procrastinate when you're particularly something as important as culture. And he invited everyone over, and it was the same day that the Fort Hood massacre had happened.
Yeah.
And several of the women came to me and they said, "I'm not sure he's going to come because he's dealing with that." And I said, "I think he'll be here." And I had already gone to all the women ahead of time and I'd said, "Look, he's interested in a candid and open conversation. Don't you walk in there and say everything's fine, because then I'm going to look ridiculous, right?" And they're like, no, we're going to be really honest with him." And what I remember most about the meeting, not only was everybody honest with him, but what he said was this. He said, "Look, if I know it's a tough environment, we're going through a terrible crisis, but I handpicked you. You're here for a reason. If you don't speak up, I will not make as informed a decision as if you do speak up. So you're not doing your job if you don't talk up." Well, you tell a group of women they're not doing their job, let me tell you, they're going to speak up. And he said, "Look, we're going to work on this culture. And right now I got the best players on the field. I want to have the best team. And you are a part of that team." And at the end of the dinner, he said, "Look, give me a minute. We're going to work on this together. But if you think you need another dinner with me, tell Valerie and she'll organize it." And so instead, I started organizing dinners with the women. And we got to be friends with each other. We talked about what was happening in our personal lives and movies and what book had we read. And then when you go into a meeting and you have that kinship, it's actually easier to speak up. Plus,
sure.
The President of the United States had said, "I care about what you have to say." And I would say by the end of the first term, not only did he have the best players on the field, I think he had the best team.
Yeah, and I have to say, I had Alyssa Mastromonaco on just a couple of weeks ago,
oh,
and she
yes.
recounted that story and said how much she appreciated you standing up for the women in the White House. Then.
Yes, her new book.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing.
Yeah, and she also talked about the gifts of jewelry that you both received when you went to Saudi Arabia.
That was unbelievable. This incredible suitcase full of jewels, none of which we could keep, but fun to look at for a moment.
Yeah. Well, I want to fast forward to election night, the evening of November 8th, 2016. You had the unique vantage point of being with the Obamas for the election returns. How did that evening play out inside the White House?
poorly, as you could imagine. The first lady said, okay, that's it, I'm going to bed. And I said, really, you're going to bed? She goes, yep, I'm going to bed. And you could just, I mean, the pall that began to creep in as the returns came in was palpable. I ended up going down and spending some time with President Obama's political director and my chief of staff, who had been the political director in President Obama's last campaign. And we watched it just get worse and worse and worse. And then I remember my daughter was staying with me at the time, and she came in to the office, or into our home at 3 a.m. from work, and she said, well, President Trump is going to be the president. And I thought, oh my gosh, how could this have happened? And then the next day I had to address my team, and then the President Obama addressed the nation and really hoped for continuity of government, because that's what the American people have the right to expect. And that's what President Bush did for us. He was extraordinarily supportive during the transition, and President Obama directed us to do the same. And it didn't matter that we were from a different party. You try to give your successor the chance to hit the ground running.
Yeah.
And so that's what we tried to do.
And as someone who had stayed on with the staff at the White House and not gone over to the Clinton campaign in 2016, did you follow the election that closely that year? Were you at all worried that Donald Trump might win?
No. And that was my error. I actually thought that, you know, a country that elected Barack Obama twice would elect Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And I certainly thought, as President Obama had said many times, that of all the people who were running, she was certainly the most qualified. She was more qualified than either Bill Clinton or Barack Obama when they were elected, given her experience as a first lady, as a senator, and as a secretary of state. So it was profoundly disappointing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you try to figure out what happened. And where I zeroed in on, and it's one of the areas where I'm spending a lot of my time now, is that 43% of the country did not vote. Eligible voters didn't vote.
Yeah.
Well, a democracy requires civic engagement, and the most fundamental responsibility of that is to vote. And so how can we go about trying to convince people, particularly young people who disproportionately don't vote in higher numbers, why it's in their self-interest to do so? And I think I'm worried about this phenomenon of shunning institutions, mm-hmm. and the fact that we now kind of create our own community and our device in the palm of our hand, and it's easier for us to shut out voices that we don't want to hear, that make us uncomfortable, and just really have a kind of an echo chamber. And that doesn't give you an appreciation for what it means to be a part of a society.
Yeah.
And there's a difference between your own self-defined community and your society. And so I want to encourage young people to see themselves as having a voice in who leads our country, and appreciating the impact that government can have in a very positive way or in a very negative way. And we get the government we deserve.
As you have to watch Donald Trump essentially trying to erase the Obama presidency, and now even talking about taking another run at dismantling the Affordable Care Act, which you put so much of your own energy into, what's been the hardest blow?
Well, I think what's hard for me is traveling around the country, as I have the privilege of doing now, and hearing the fear in so many people who are worried about, well, I have a pre-existing condition, and if they take away the Affordable Care Act, will my premiums be cost prohibitive?
Yeah.
Or will I hit a lifetime or even an annual cap that means that I'm going to have to come out of pocket and choose between paying my rent and having health insurance? Or people who are worried because they have a child with asthma and they're seeing rolling back all of these environmental protections, or what we talked about in terms of working families, requiring employers to not penalize their workers who share compensation. Well, how do you know if you're getting equal pay if you can't even talk about it? So there are lots of different fronts where I'm concerned, not because of the work we put in, because that's what's expected of you. You get there and you have the privilege of working in the White House. You better work as hard as you can. And you know that it's time limited, which is why we tried so hard to do legislation on issues like immigration reform or background checks or guns or criminal justice reform, to name three that I'm disappointed didn't go through, because you know your successor has the privilege of reversing what's done by executive order. And it's been very challenging to see the impact it's having on our country, not to mention how we are viewed around the world. And I think about the separation of families at the border and people coming here seeking asylum because they're living in unbelievably harsh conditions, and our laws allow people to come here and seek asylum. That's playing by the rules. And the thought that we would tear families apart and not even keep track of where the children and parents are so that they could be reunified, and to think that that will then teach people not to come here. We have always been a nation of immigrants and a nation of laws. And I think our values reflect that we should do better than we've been doing.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the danger of, I don't know, the sense of people treating politics as theater these days.
Yes.
And this callousness is that you forget that it really does affect actual people's lives.
Absolutely.
Well, I appreciate your talking to me. I know you have to go. Real quickly before we go, you have a chapter titled Pinch Myself Moment. What was your favorite?
I'll give you two.
Okay.
And the pinch, for those who haven't read my book yet, I hope you do, but they're really about our travels around the world. And when I lived in London, I used to drag my parents down to Buckingham Palace every weekend to watch the changing of the guards. And I'd stand outside the wrought iron fence, and for hours I would have stood there just watching the guards. And so to be able to be in a motorcade, presidential motorcade, and the gates opened up, and there we went into the Buckingham Palace and met the Queen, who couldn't have been more gracious and kind. And it just was like a dream come true for me. So that's one. And then I had an extraordinary trip to Dharamsala to visit the Dalai Lama as an emissary for President Obama. And His Holiness was gracious enough to give me a couple of hours of his time. And before he'd arrived, I'd visited an orphanage, and I'd visited with several of the people who lived in this really exiled community that was Tibet in India, where the government of India had provided the Dalai Lama with this land as a refuge for those who had left Tibet. And he was such a joyful spirit. And I thought, my goodness, you know what? He's lived over 50 years in exile, and yet he's still a happy, good-spirited person. I got nothing to complain about. And I tried to let him get into my soul and say, let me be the best person and the most joyful person I can be.
Yeah, yeah. I think Obama later teased you when he met the Dalai Lama and said, oh, this is the woman who says you changed her life.
And the Dalai Lama said, with a big belly laugh, ah, she exaggerates. But he didn't. I didn't exaggerate. He did make my life better. Yeah.
Well, once again, the book is called Finding My Voice, My Journey to the West Wing and the Path Forward. Valerie Jarrett, thanks for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Thanks again to Valerie Jarrett for coming on the podcast. Order her new book, Finding My Voice, My Journey to the West Wing and the Path Forward, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And follow her on Twitter at Valerie Jarrett. Whatever struggles you're facing, from depression and anxiety to trauma and grief, BetterHelp can connect you with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions, as well as chat or text with your therapist. And anything you share is completely confidential. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners can even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started? Simply go to betterhelp.com/kick and fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a counselor you'll love today. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.